From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the power of the mind. Here's what's happening. Another veiled threat from North Korea. This is kind of getting out of hand. Unlike most, this one was very specific. The state-run television in the People's Republic reported that North Korea's arsenal of deadly weapons now includes a hydrogen bomb that could wipe out New York City and kill everyone who lives there. The remarks, first reported by the Washington Post, followed a stage show of the country's military power last week, where the leader, Kim Jong-un, was filmed inspecting the silver sphere. The object is believed to be a miniature nuclear warhead of a hydrogen bomb. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has just revealed that 124 illegal immigrant criminals released from jail by the Obama administration since 2010 have subsequently been charged with 138 murders. Can you believe that? Russian President Vladimir Putin has ordered a partial pullout of the Russian military from Syria after saying his troops largely achieved their combat goals in the country. He also ordered the country's diplomatic efforts to be stepped up to secure a peace in Syria. The move was announced on the day that the UN-backed peace talks on Syria resumed in Geneva. Let's check in with Jerry Corsi, of course, noted author. Jerry, what do you think by this specific move by Putin to get his troops out of Syria?
Well, it was a surprise move today, George. It wasn't really telegraphed at all. But I think Russia has largely achieved its goals. When Russia invaded Syria in September, the Assad regime was very shaky. Now, some six months later, Russia has boosted the strength of Assad. Russia, even in February, was flying 60 or 70 sorties a day. And now the Assad regime is even threatening to take back Aleppo, which is one of the major commercial centers in Syria. So I think Russia felt like it's going into these peace talks with a secure position for Assad. They've left both a air base and a military base for the Navy, so Russia can return anytime it wants. They experimented with new weapons, launching some 26 cruise missiles from ships in the Caspian Sea at targets in Syria. I mean, this was a success for Russia, and it reduces cost with Russia already pressed by low oil prices. Russia saves money. It's kind of like the Minimax solution. They spent the minimum amount of money and got the maximum result in supporting Assad.
And where do we stand in Syria right now, Jerry? Are we still bombing away too?
Well, somewhat, George, but it's hard to know where we stand. I mean, we supported certain of the rebel groups, which then turned out to be affiliated with ISIS or other al-Qaeda groups. The Obama administration had a very kind of confused and muddled strategy. We had a red line for Assad that we ignored. I mean, basically, the Kerry, as Secretary of State, has really not accomplished anything effectively for the United States. ISIS is still on the rise in Syria and throughout the region, and Russia did not establish a goal of eliminating ISIS. Russia established a goal of propping up Assad, and that was achieved. So I think Russia goes into these peace talks with the upper hand, and it's going to be very difficult to dislodge Assad, especially with Russia having the ability to move the military right back into Syria anytime Russia decides to do so.
Jerry, tomorrow, another Super Tuesday. We're getting close, but lots of problems in the Donald Trump camp with what's been going on lately.
Well, certainly these protesters have caused major problems for the Trump campaign, and I think blaming Donald Trump for them is maybe blaming the victim a bit, especially with these protests being clearly organized and funded, even funded by George Soros. Also, I think Trump has got to tone down his rhetoric.
Yes.
Can't be saying, let's punch out the protesters. That's certainly not acceptable. And it's going to be a test if this continues throughout the campaign. But I expect everyone's going to get more effective in managing and handling the protesters, and certainly a backlash. I mean, in 1968, the protests, the Democratic Convention ended up helping electing Richard Nixon. And I suspect, George, we're going to find tomorrow that some of these protests may have actually boosted Trump's showing in the primaries.
Could be.
So,
could be.
You know, it's going to be very interesting tomorrow. It's going to also be very interesting to see how Hillary Clinton fares against Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders seems to be surging in the Democratic polls. So I expect we're going to see very interesting shifts in the primary races in both parties tomorrow. And I expect the nation will be watching very carefully.
We're going to see how all of this unfolds. Jerry, thank you so much. Malaysia's transport minister said that two pieces of a plane found in Mozambique will be sent to Australia to verify if they belong to that missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. That flight, of course, vanished March 8, 2014. Geez, 2 years ago already, with 239 people on board flying from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Family and friends of a 22-year-old British woman are grieving her death after doctors mistook a very rare form of cancer as a pregnancy. Demi Wright, she was a makeup artist, began complaining of pain in her side in November. When she went to the doctor's office, tests suggested that she had high hormone levels associated with pregnancy, so the doctor sent her to the maternity ward. Months passed, her pain did not subside, and then in February, doctors at a hospital in Cambridge found Wright actually had an aggressive form of cancer that affects multiple organs and was diagnosed as terminal. She passed away last month. Well, do you feel like you lost an hour today? Everybody does, well, because of DST. And people complain about daylight saving time because they lose that hour of sleep. But a recent study has found that the change in time can also pose very serious health risks. The study, published in the American Academy of Neurology, found that DST may be associated with a higher risk of a blood clot in the brain. Why is this? We'll check in with resident psychiatrist Peter Bregan. Peter, how come just a switch of time would do this to somebody?
Well, I don't think it's going to turn out to be so, George, because I can't imagine how it would do so either. I mean, it can cause emotional problems. We know that for sure, because we don't want to go to bed at the right time, so we stay up later, and then we got to still get up in the morning, and we lose sleep, and it's darker out, and we're grumpy and tired, and it throws off the basic rhythms that are biological and habitual, the circadian rhythms. I got a few suggestions for people about how to handle it, other
sure.
than seeing your neurologist. You know, there are conventional things that people do. They snack on some carbs. It's not always the best thing. You want to keep your room darker. That's not a bad idea when you're getting ready for bed, because light suppresses melatonin, and you want that melatonin and other things that are going on to respond to the darkness. Avoid alcohol. It feels good, may make you feel a little sleepy, but eventually your brain says, no, I've got to wake up. Don't like the alcohol. Avoid caffeine. Do something comforting. But what I think is most important is if you can use your relationships, because what really keeps us up at night is anxiety and distress mm-hmm. that relates to the daytime. So I suggest strongly that if you don't have a couple, stay in touch with people you love before bed if you're having trouble sleeping. Call somebody. Call your mom, your dad, your kids, your friend. And if you have a partner, make evening a special, kind, and gentle time. Make it a time when you consciously say, we're going to be kind and gentle starting at 9 p.m. or whatever time you pick. Do something nice that's physical. Sex is fine. But people often are going to relax more if they just rub each other's backs, rub each other's feet, remind each other you love each other, and make a moratorium on serious conversations for an hour or two before you go to bed. And all that could help a lot.
Sure would. Thanks, Jerry. And, you know, a study in 2012 at the University of Alabama in Birmingham showed that a 10% increase in heart attacks followed DST, and that the rate decreased by 10% after DST. Can you believe that? Dr. Peter Breggin, he's a great psychiatrist. A study from the University of Milan in Italy found that an amazing 6 out of 10 people report having contact with a loved one who has passed away. We have this story in our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. These experiences, say, they can include sight, sound, smells, or simply sensing the presence of their departed loved one. Despite the apparent prevalence of such events, the researchers reason that most people do not report them because they're afraid of being judged or ridiculed. Up next, we're going to talk about surveillance and terrorism in a very special book, The God's Eye View, Barry Eisler, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Barry Eisler spent 3 years in a covert position with the CIA's Directorate of Operations. Then he worked as a technology lawyer and startup executive in the Silicon Valley and in Japan as well. He lives out there in the San Francisco Bay Area. Now, when he's not writing novels, and we're going to be talking about The God's Eye View, he blogs about torture, civil liberties, the rule of law. Barry, it's good to have you here. So many topics to talk with you about tonight. My gosh.
Thanks, Judge. Good to be here.
You put your work into a novel form, but it's also like nonfiction. It's real stuff.
Yeah, I try to make everything in my novels as realistic as I can. And since I write thrillers, I think that's generally the right thing to do, right? A thriller is supposed to thrill. It's supposed to scare people. And if what you're writing about doesn't feel like it could at least be real, if not, it probably is real to your readers, then they won't be thrilled. So yeah, I try to make my plots as close to reality as I can understand and intuit it as possible.
Here we are in this day and age with technology, Barry, at its all-time high, and at the same time, surveillance, spying, grabbing information from people is also at an all-time high. It's not going to get any less, is it?
I think the best hope in that regard is ubiquitous, strong, and easy to use encryption. Because what the law says is what the government may not do. What encryption says is what the government cannot do. And if there's one thing we've learned from the revelations of whistleblower Edward Snowden and the various federal court decisions that have followed declaring various government surveillance programs to be illegal and unconstitutional, we've learned that the government will ignore the law when it thinks it can get away with it. So when it comes to surveillance, I don't think new laws, even if we could have some, and the prospects of that aren't great, new laws demonstrably won't do the trick. I think what we need is something that will actually physically prevent the government from bulk surveillance, and the only thing that will work in that regard, again, is encryption.
You know, and there are some people in the camp that say that Edward Snowden is a hero, and then you have probably the same amount of numbers that say that he's a villain.
Yeah, I think the polls on that go back and forth, but the most recent Pew Research that I've seen indicates that over time more and more Americans are appreciating that Snowden is a whistleblower and a hero rather than a villain. But you know what?
Time heals.
Say again, sorry, Georgia.
Time heals.
Yeah, exactly. I think regardless of where people want to come down on this, what they should understand and probably won't understand if they only get their news from establishment outlets is this. A lot of times people talk about how Edward Snowden violated his oath of secrecy. And I'll tell you what, there's going to be 100% correlation between anyone who takes a position that Snowden is a villain and the belief that he violated his so-called oath of secrecy. But I'm here to tell you, as a former CIA case officer, that there is no oath of secrecy. Anyone who talks about a governmental oath of secrecy is either lying, is a propagandist, or is ignorant. There's no oath of secrecy. There is a secrecy agreement. It's what in Silicon Valley we call a non-disclosure agreement, an NDA. You say, I'm going to receive secret information and I'm going to keep that information secret. It's not an oath akin to the president's oath of office. It's just a contract. So trying to turn this thing into some sort of oath when in fact it's just a contract is at a minimum inherently propagandistic. But it's even worse than that, because all intelligence employees do swear an actual oath. And that oath is to protect and defend the Constitution.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So regardless of where anyone comes down on the question of whether Snowden's a hero or a villain or whatever, you can't in any kind of productive, honest way approach that question unless you first acknowledge that Snowden didn't swear a secrecy oath. There's no such thing. He did sign a secrecy agreement, and he did also swear an oath to protect and defend the Constitution. You can argue, if you think he's a bad guy, that the Constitution wasn't being violated. You'd have to argue with the findings of several federal courts in that regard. But okay, you could say that the Constitution wasn't being violated, or that someone should have done something, but he went about it in the wrong way. You can make those sorts of arguments, but you can't argue that he wasn't faced with two competing alternatives. One was a secrecy contract, and the other was an oath to protect the Constitution.
I finally broke down and watched the latest James Bond film, Spectre.
I
watched it on Amazon, and it was the worst James Bond movie I've ever seen, Barry.
A lot of people didn't like it. I enjoyed it, but I'm kind of a sucker for James.
Well, but what you probably liked, and that's what I'm going to ask you, is about the technology that was involved with the guy who was trying to overthrow the planet.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely gratifying to me to see Snowden's work manifesting itself in popular culture, the most popular culture, right? A James Bond movie where the plot has to do with the government rolling out this program in the name of fighting terrorism that's actually going to spy on the doings of ordinary people. And by ordinary people, I mean people who might be considered a threat to the state, any politician who steps out of line, journalists, dissidents, that sort of thing. And by the way, it's interesting to me. I mean, of course, Spectre is depicting this sort of villainy in a fictional setting. But for anyone who wants to get too comfortable about the notion that, oh, come on, the government would never use the machinery of the government, whether it's surveillance, law enforcement, security, intelligence, the government would never turn that sort of machinery against domestic dissent. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's enough to make you laugh, right? I mean, but for anyone who's listening, if you're curious about this, if you want to see past this prologue, Google COINTELPRO. It stands for Counterintelligence Program, COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO, which was a program of domestic surveillance and sabotage, run by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI.
Oh, Hoover was one of the worst. If he had our technology today, Barry, he'd be out of control.
Exactly. And it's strange that people don't realize the one thing that never changes is human nature. The technology gets more and more advanced, but human nature stays the same. And there's so much evidence, historical common sense and otherwise, to guide us in this regard. I mean, James, what I would do if I could teach high school civics, if I could design the curriculum, first thing I would do is I would have people reading James Madison, just all the Madisonian quotes, because it's all in there. He said that the means of defense against foreign danger historically have become the instruments of tyranny at home. That's something to think about in an age of drones and bulk surveillance. I mean, maybe Madison didn't know what he was talking about. It was all very pre-9/11. But I wish people would pay a little more attention to that sort of thing, as well as to abuses like COINTELPRO, which was aimed at student groups, anti-war groups, the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
These are all, in the end, what are considered to be the real enemies of the state. You know, your previous guest was talking about Syria, Assad, ISIS, all that kind of stuff. I think if you think about it, a group like ISIS or a bad guy like Assad, you know, Congress, in a tremendous act of bravery, just passed this resolution condemning both the Syrian government and ISIS of genocide. It's like, wow, at last somebody is speaking out against ISIS. These sorts of foreign bad actors offer nothing but upside to America's oligarchy, or call it establishment if you want to be a little more polite about it, to the military-industrial complex, mm-hmm. which today is more military-industrial prison security intelligence border control complex, nothing but upside. There's nothing but power to be gained and profits to be made. These are not the real enemies of America's state. The real enemies of the state are always dissidents, always anti-war groups, always the groups that are really questioning the established order. The established order begins to look at those groups as the real enemies of that established order and then to turn its power against them. It's always
rather than embrace them to find out why they're upset.
Well, they probably have some sense of why they're upset and don't want to listen because, look, like why would anyone be upset? This is another thing I heard you guys talking about.
Hold on for a second, Barry. Yeah. We're already at the bottom of the hour, but we'll be right back. We'll talk more about the God's Eye View next. Welcome back with Barry Eisler, the God's Eye View. And, Barry, we're talking a little bit about the specter and the kind of technology that is available. Do you think hidden away in some stronghold, we have that kind of system where government is spying on everything?
Yeah, I think the way to put it, to be accurate, isn't that the government is spying on everything, but that the government has reached a point where it's capable of spying on, if not everything, then almost everything.
If they want
certainly
to.
All meaningful electronic behavior, the internet, email, telephone calls, that sort of thing.
Tell me about the name, The God's Eye View, of your book.
So in the book, there's a program of wide-reaching bulk surveillance, population surveillance, and the director of the NSA, who's a character in the book, has named this secret program God's Eye, and the reason is right there in the description of the system. It can see everything by design. So I put something in there that's intended to be a little lighthearted, but it resonates in the story where his executive assistant is telling him, look, I don't think we should call this thing God's Eye. If it ever gets out, it's a bad name. People aren't going to like it. But the director is really enamored of it because it's just so perfectly descriptive. And they have an argument about some other programs that the U.S. government has actually rolled out with either success or less success. And you can pretty much correlate the success or failure of these programs with the kind of marketing names they've been given. So, for example, when under the Reagan administration, John Poindexter tried to roll out something called Total Information Awareness under the National Security Council, everyone got panicked about it. Congress, the population, people like Total Information Awareness. That doesn't sound good. Bad name, scared people. Similarly, about 20 years ago, the FBI tried to roll out an email sniffing program. All of this, by the way, is fairly primitive compared to the sorts of programs that Edward Snowden has revealed. But the FBI tried to roll out an email sniffing program and called it Carnivore. And again, that got shot down once word got out because people are thinking, I don't know, Carnivore, that doesn't sound good. But when the government gets the name right, people just smile, right? So I think the Patriot Act, the Freedom Act. I mean, these are just great marketing names. Who wants to argue against patriotism or freedom? So these guys argue about that sort of thing with using real government programs as examples. And these are the sorts of things that I hope people will come away from my books thinking about a little bit. I mean, what do you think the government's really doing when it names something the Patriot Act? You feel like the government's being honest with you?
Or Homeland Security, for crying out.
Great name, exactly. You know, Homeland itself, to me, is pretty Orwellian. But before 9/11, that word wasn't, there was no real American English word for homeland. There's a German word, Heimat. Maybe Homeland is derived from that, not by coincidence. That comes from German. But before 9/11, nobody talked about Homeland. So if you were to, for example, call the Department of Homeland Security the Department of State Security, would have a much more ominous feeling. So that's clever marketing, changing the name of what used to be called the War Department to the Defense Department. Again, clever marketing. And by the way, anytime something is being named more for its ostensible purpose than by the means it uses to achieve that ostensible purpose, it's worth asking whether you're getting BS'd. So, for example, to me, a quintessential example would be the NSA itself, the National Security Administration. What does that really mean? I mean, what administration, what agency of the U.S. government isn't, at least in some way, dedicated to preserving the security of the American people? It's an incredibly vague name referring to the ostensible purpose of the organization. What it should really be called is the National Surveillance Agency. But that would be a bit of a scary name, and people might protest. Name it something vague, and people think it's going to be okay.
And most people nowadays, Barry, they're convinced that government is trying to upend them because they just don't trust government, rightfully so or wrongfully so, of course.
Right.
And when you look at things like this current election, I've never seen anything like this before. I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's new for me too. I mean, I wasn't of age, say, in 1968 with the police riots outside the Chicago Democratic mm-hmm. Convention, or the country convulsed over the war in Vietnam. But yeah, it seems really bad. I don't think it's so shocking, really. I mean, if anything, shocking, you could argue it's shocking that this kind of pushback against what I usually refer to as the duopoly. Like, a lot of times people say, oh, we need a third party in America. And my usual response to that is, I'll tell you what, if we could get a second to start with, that'd be awesome. So I really don't, if you look at all the different political possibilities, there aren't, and you'll see that the Democratic wing and the Republican wing, or the war party or the corporate party or whatever you want to call it, their differences are far smaller than their overlap. The things they fight about are much less significant than the things they agree about. It's just that the only thing that gets covered is a fight, because it's interesting. It makes good media. You don't see much coverage of anything that the parties broadly agree on. So I could go on about this for a while, but in terms of what's going on in the current election, it's not so shocking, because if you look at where economic gains have been delivered over, say, the last 20 years, I mean, it's all gone to 1% of the population. Yeah. You don't have to be a member in good standing of, say, Occupy Wall Street to just look at those graphs and understand that all the economic gains in the country over the course of the last 20 years have gone to 1% of the population. So 1% of the population has gotten fabulously wealthy since, say, the Reagan administration. These trends have continued. While the rest of the country has seen its income level, its standard of living, either stagnate or fall back. And at some point, all the slick marketing in the world about how we have to keep pumping money into the military and we need more wars to keep us safe because the terrorists want to climb through our bedroom windows with scimitars and slaughter us in our sleep, all that kind of fear-mongering in the world can't forever obscure the fact that the system is fundamentally rigged. How else do you explain so much wealth created going to so few people? How else do you explain a taxpayer-funded Wall Street bailout that turned into Wall Street bonuses for the people who are getting bailed out, turned into nothing for the rest of the country?
You have a knack for predicting events in your novels. How do you do that?
Thanks for that. I think it's three things. It's one, I read a lot. I read a lot of news. I don't read very much in from the usual suspects, the establishment media. So I don't get it. I get almost none of my news from television. So like CNN, Fox, MSNBC, very little news from that. Mostly, let's call it alternative news sources. And I read pretty closely and broadly. And I think about these things a lot, and then I blog about them on my website, barryeisler.com. And I've got a certain view of human nature. We were talking about this earlier, that's informed by a sense of history. So my view of human nature has a lot to do with Madison. It's, if all men were angels, we wouldn't even need government, and men of power should be distrusted. I mean, this is all Madison, and it's the way I look at these things, too. And then I look at history, not just overseas, not just, say, East Germany and the Stasi, but also closer to home, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. And I see what happens when people are given vast power without commensurate transparency and accountability. And then I put those things together, my reading about current events, my take on human nature, my understanding of history, and I ask myself, based on what I know, based on what I'm reading about that's being reported in the news today, what do I think is going on between the lines? And that's what I wind up writing about in the plots for my stories. And it's amazing how much of this stuff comes to pass. I mean, I'm not trying to pat myself on the back. It's not, you don't have to be psychic. You just have to do the three things I said. So there was... the book I wrote, my second book, Lonely Resurrection, which I wrote from 2002-2003, So this is 8 years before a Japanese tsunami and the meltdown at Fukushima, the Tokyo Electric Power Company meltdown. There's a scene in the book, and the book has to do with corruption in Japan, among other things. And one of my characters actually says, there have been so many near misses in Japan, financial, ecological, nuclear, it's only a matter of time before a true cataclysm occurs. This is a quote, perhaps a nuclear accident that irradiates an entire city. And he's talking specifically about Tokyo Electric Power and these facts that they found on the concrete shrouds on some of these reactors. So this is something I was reading about at the time, and I thought, this sounds really bad. It's probably worse than the government and the Japanese government is letting on.
Yeah.
And why would that be? Because what is Japan going to do if it has to shut down all its nuclear reactors? It's going to be terrible for the economy. They import all their oil. The government wouldn't want the populace to be unduly concerned, and by unduly I mean accurately, concerned about corruption at TEPCO and resulting problems at the nuclear reactors. So my guess was the government is underplaying this stuff. And if they're underplaying it, there's no transparency, nobody's being prosecuted for any of these safety violations, then the violations are going to get worse. And I was right. 8 years later, 9 years later, Fukushima had a complete meltdown.
And you know what? We're going to have more of that, Barry.
Of course. Of course. Look at the financial system. It's a classic example. I mean, even Alan Greenspan said that that the subprime mortgage meltdown was a case of massive fraud, but nobody was prosecuted. In fact, we bailed out Wall Street, and none of the people who were responsible for the meltdown were prosecuted. Nobody did any prison time. What's the inevitable consequence of something like that? Well, Wall Street people are now incentivized to gamble again, and maybe gamble even more because they know they're too big to fail. They know the system is rigged. They'll do it again. It's just, these are almost laws of human nature. Again, you don't have to be psychic. You just have to pay attention.
Barry, why are they demonizing Donald Trump? You know, I've watched this guy for years, and I've watched him closely lately. And, I mean, he, regardless of his politics and whether you agree with him or not, I mean, the guy's not evil, but he's being portrayed as that.
So I think the best way to look at Donald Trump is, one, to look at his suggested policies, and two, to look at his rhetoric. Those are not things that you can completely separate, but I think it's useful to try to. So, because your first question is, why do people demonize him? So I think the notion that we would do well to build a wall on the border with Mexico, something, say, reminiscent of the Berlin Wall, is probably going to offend a lot of Hispanic Americans who are over here legally, or even if they're over here illegally. They're hardworking people. They're just looking for a way to...
And people in general. A wall's not going to stop anybody.
Of course not. Of course not.
If you've got a 40-foot wall, they're going to get a 45-foot ladder. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Inevitably. And the notion that that America should build not a physical wall, but some sort of barrier by which it would prevent Muslims from, you know, bear in mind that there are over 1 billion Muslims in the world from, I don't know, there must be at least 50 nations on earth that are majority Muslims.
Sure.
Muslims living in almost every country on earth. You're talking about something like 1.6 billion people, I think, maybe it's 1.8 billion, but a lot of the planet's human beings happen to be Muslim. The notion that we should keep them all out, forget about the logistics and how crazy all that is. Forget even about the possible unconstitutionality of such a claim. It ignores the fact that we have, I don't know, uncountable thousands, tens of thousands of Muslim Americans serving in the armed forces, serving in law enforcement. These people are 100% American, the same as any other American. And the notion that if they were to leave the country, maybe we can't let them back in because there's some kind of sleepers. And I think Trump might have clarified this a little bit to say, like, oh, no, this would only apply to non-citizen Muslims. But still, when he first issued his proclamation, it was going to apply to all Muslims. Mm-hmm. So these policies, I think, are the kinds of policies people would find divisive and hateful. And I should just say, George, I mean, I'm trying to describe this as though I'm some sort of neutral like I'm the watcher on the moon in Marvel Comics describing these goings on Earth, and they have nothing to do with me. But I find these things insane, hateful, and just completely un-American. So as policies, I think they're unworkable. This notion that what we should do is this vast engineering, this vast unworkable, impossible engineering project from one end of the border of Mexico to the other, or that we should try logistically to keep out 1.8 billion people. So like members of 1.8 billion people, we should do that until, as he puts it, we figure out what's going on. Like, here's a suggestion for Donald Trump. It's probably going to be easier for us to figure out what's going on than to change all our laws to keep all these people out. So, and then as far as, so that's, those are policies. And again, you can't completely separate them.
Yet his popularity is zooming.
Yeah, I think.
Which is an interesting. We'll find out a lot tomorrow in another Super Tuesday election. We'll see if it wanes or not. But
yeah, it's hard to say because it's interesting to consider how the violence at his Chicago rally is going to affect people. I mean, some people blame it on want to blame it on the people who are protesting, and I don't know. I saw videos. There's a lot going on there. I did see videos. A lot of those protesters had their arms linked together as a classic sign of, hey, we're not throwing any punches. We're not doing anything. We're not being violent. This gets to Trump's rhetoric. I mean, if you watch clips of the rhetoric over, say, the last month of his campaign stops, he's been escalating every step of the way, and some of it is really crazy. You don't even have to take a position on whether he's a proto-Hitler or a fascist or anything like that to be extremely concerned about a person who's running for president and says things like, punch him in the face, don't hurt him, but you know what, if you do, I'll pay the legal bill.
Yeah, I know. Stupid stuff.
Oh, you know what?
Stupid.
You know, protesters, they used to be carried out on stretchers. We used to know how to deal with protesters, but now we have to be so politically correct. I mean, there was a lot of people on social media were doing a good job of juxtaposing his comments with photographs from earlier era in America, the Kent State shootings, dead students. So, hey, we used to know how to deal with protesters. The Chicago riots in 1968, the police turning fire hoses and attack dogs on civil rights protesters. Yeah, we sure did know. You used to know how to deal with protesters. I don't know. What's Trump talking about when he says we used to know how to deal with protesters and we don't do it anymore? He hasn't said. But that kind of rhetoric, to me, suggests that he would like to go back to an era where whatever means are being used, they result in protesters being taken out on stretchers. That's maybe I'm too literal-minded, but I don't think so. That's getting pretty close to incitement to violence, if it doesn't indeed go over the edge, and I would argue.
Whether you intend it or not, I mean, it's possible, very possible, the guy speaks before he thinks.
You know, that would be the charitable interpretation, but do we really want a president who speaks before he thinks, who says
no.
Things that will have the effect, if not the purpose, will have the effect of stirring up this kind of hatred and inciting violence? I mean, if you saw the video of that 78-year-old white guy who stepped in, there was a black guy being led out of a Trump rally. He was being led out by security people.
And the guy punched him. Is that
he
the one?
He stepped in and tried to, he did elbow him right in the face. Luckily,
yeah.
He didn't know how to throw a good elbow. It wasn't a good position, so it didn't look like it did that much damage. But this, I try to be a little cautious about coming to conclusions based on a video, because depending on the angle or what's been cut, you can really get manipulated. But man, it is just, I don't think it's possible to look at that as anything other than battery.
There's a lot of hate out there. There's a lot of hate. Barry, we're going to take this break, but we're going to come back and continue talking about your work, The God's Eye View. I want to get specific into the book, and then we'll take some phone calls as well. Barry's website, as he mentioned, barryeisler.com. I'll spell it for you, BarryEisler. It's all linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. We've got it for one more hour, and we're going to take your calls in that hour as well.